Please join me as I pray. So, Lord, we stand before you, the one who this morning in this text will speak out of the whirlwind. And my request is that we would be a listening people, and that as we listen, you would expand our perspective, give us new eyes to see new and glorious things, and in the midst of it all, God, that you would provide comfort that only comes from seeing and knowing you. Come and tend to your people. Speak, your servants are listening. We pray it in Jesus' name, amen. We have been on a journey through the book of Job, asking the question, how can we be the sorts of people that suffer faithfully, and how can we be the sorts of people that walk with those who are suffering? We've been examining both of those things as two threads, looking at Job and looking at his friends, and now we've arrived as both of these threads converge in the presence of God himself. And this week and next week, we are going to hear what it looks like when God shows up and he speaks into the place of pain, when divine comfort is expressed and experienced. And one thing that I've recognized as I've been sitting with this text is that loss experienced, either personally or as the comforter standing next to the person walking through loss, it represents a loss of control. Pain, suffering, disappointment, it feels so chaotic. Feels so out of control. And I've recognized as we look back over all that we've done together through the book of Job, Job and his friends both are dealing with the intensity of chaotic and seemingly purposeless and overwhelming loss. And they're trying with explanatory power to regain their control. In a sense, we do the same. We grasp at trying to regain our control when confronting real loss and sadness and disappointment. And when God shows up and God speaks, we're going to recognize that he is aiming at a very different destination altogether. As he speaks, we're going to recognize that this pursuit of being in control was always a farce. We never were. Our suffering has introduced us to, or our disappointment has introduced us to, the reality that has always been the case. We never had control. And when God shows up, he's going to speak and saying, I'm not trying to help you regain the charade of your control. I'm delivering you into something so much deeper and better and truer. I am going to deliver you into silent awe. No longer trying to be in control, but experiencing real, overwhelming, soul-stirring, and soul-satisfying worship. God's going to speak, and he's going to take us to a different destination altogether. And I don't want us to miss how stunning the verses that Melissa just read for us were, especially the first one, that at the end of all of this back and forth between Job and his friends, it says that the Lord answered Job. Is that startling to anybody? Here they are wrestling with all that's going on, and the Lord is going to show up and speak. And I think we just need to recognize as we enter in, we're entering into sacred ground, that this is what everything has been building to, that as Job has honestly and communally and prayerfully processed in the context of friends that sometimes didn't know how to produce the right sort of comfort, that there in that very human, very flawed, very gritty exchange, God shows up and he speaks. This is the climax. This is the point. This is the story of Job, that we as weak, flawed people who are confused and trying to make sense of a chaotic world at times, that in the midst of all of our brokenness and flawed in exchange, God shows up and he tends to us. This is going to be that moment where Michelangelo steps into the Sistine Chapel and delivers a tour. You know, you could listen to every art critic, you could study every lecture, you could know all that there is, but there's something different that when the artist steps in and says, let me give you a tour, let me tell you about what's going on here. Some of what he says may sound like things you've heard from art critics, but you're forgetting all that they've said at that point because you're going, the artist is explaining the work. And in this moment, the Lord is going to speak and he's going to bring clarity, power, and deliver worship. He's on a different path. And he's going to speak in such a way that silences the critics and reveals himself. And so we're going to do something a little different this morning. As I've been preparing to preach on God finally speaking for himself, it felt rather inappropriate for me just to launch in and begin explaining without letting the Lord speak for himself. And so I'm going to ask that we all stand, if you would. And picking up right where Melissa left off, we're going to enter in and stand under the weight of God speaking for himself. Fair warning, the first half of the speech that we're reading together takes about 7 minutes to read aloud. Would you ask for the Spirit's help to stay focused, to hear God speaking out of the whirlwind? And then in the remaining balance of our time, I'll try to make a few observations about what we're experiencing together. Chapter 38, verse 2, the Lord is going to answer. This is what he says. Who is this that darkens my counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you and you make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars were singing together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you shall come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place? That it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It's changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked, their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea? Have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. Where's the way to the dwelling of light? Where is the place of darkness that you may take it to its territory and that you may discern the paths to its home? You know, for you were born then. The number of your days is great. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the times of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land where no man is, on the desert in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and the desolate land and to make the ground sprout with grass? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth, and who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades, or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season? Can you guide the bear with its children? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens, and can you establish their rule on the earth? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Who can tilt the water skins of the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and clods stick fast together? Can you hunt the prey of the lion? Or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their thicket? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young one cries to God for help and wanders about for lack of food? Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Do you know the time when they give birth? When they crouch, they bring forth their offspring and are delivered of their young. Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and do not return to them. Who has let the wild donkey go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift donkey, to whom I have given the arid plains for his home and the salt lands for his dwelling place? He scorns the tumult of the city. He hears not the shouts of the driver. He ranges the mountains as his pasture. He searches after every green thing. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind him in the furrow with ropes, or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on him because his strength is great, and will you leave him to your labor? Do you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it to the threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? For she leaves her eggs in the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beast may trample them. She deals cruelly with her young, as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom. He's given her no share in understanding. When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying. He paws in the valley, exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear and the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, "Aha!" He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars, spreads his wings towards the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on the rocky crag and the stronghold. From there he spies out the prey. His eyes behold it from afar. His young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is he. And the Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." You may be seated. There's been a cloud of mystery hanging over a conversation for 37 chapters, wondering, will God show up? And when he does so in the way that you just heard. And I just want to make a few observations about the really surprising and stunning and soul-stirring comfort that he provides in a way that no one could have predicted. You see, in order to provide divine comfort, there's three things that God's going to do, thwarting our control, but producing silent awe, producing real worship. And the first thing is this: God shows up and provides questions, not answers. Did you hear it? There's 42 question marks in those two chapters, representing somewhere between 60 and 70 questions, depending on how you categorize them in the Hebrew. It is a speech full of questions. What Job and his friends have been wrestling with is they want pinpointed answers. This is confusing and chaotic. God, we need you to show up and provide some answers. And God shows up and he does not provide pinpointed answers. What he provides is wide-ranging questions. He shows up and he speaks in a way that is very surprising, because the truth is that new questions reframe everything. They are very focused on this particular issue of Job's suffering, trying to solve, trying to regain control in the chaos of loss, trying to make sense of, I need answers to explain this loss. And God shows up and he never even addresses it. He just starts asking questions, wide-ranging, as big as the cosmos itself. And the reframing of these questions changes the conversation altogether. Henry Ford has been famously, even if, you know, spuriously quoted as saying, if people had asked me, you know, if you'd asked people in my day what they most wanted, they would have said faster, more efficient horses. The people just were trying to solve for something very specific. And he came asking a whole different set of questions that nobody even considered that produced the automobile. Or when Steve Jobs showed up, you know, anybody remember mini discs? Probably not. Sony was onto something. They were solving for smaller compact discs that you could carry in your pocket, and you could have 50 minutes of music in your pocket in a small disc. They were investing a lot of money and effort to make that take over the world. But meanwhile, Steve Jobs was asking a very different, wide-ranging set of questions, saying, I wonder if I could put a pocket-sized computer in everyone in the world's hand. Very different set of questions that changed the conversation completely. You see, God shows up and he asks a set of questions that introduce the wisdom differential. The wisdom differential. If you have a 3-year-old child who desperately wants to stick his slobbery fingers into the light socket, and you say, no, you cannot do that. He cries, and he might even have the wherewithal to say, why? And in this moment, you can consider, like, okay, electrical currents, open circuit, closed circuit, a slobbery wet finger can turn an open circuit into a closed circuit in very painful, life-altering sorts of ways. And I could try to explain, no matter how many ways I try to explain this, you don't have the categories or capacity to make sense of any of this. And so for now, the answer is no. There is a wisdom differential between a parent and their toddler. And if that wisdom differential is from the floor to this table, the wisdom differential between you and God is from here to the stars. Not even comparable. And when he shows up and the blinders are on and we're trying to solve for a very particular problem right in front of us, he shows up and it's almost as if he just starts asking questions, going, okay, look around, breathe a little, lift your head. We need to reframe the discussion because right now what you need to recognize is there is a significant wisdom differential. And if I were trying to answer your questions, I would be speaking in categories that you can't comprehend. You don't have access to it. Have you been to the deeps? Do you know how the ocean was made? Do you remember how the stars sang on the day of creation? Then I don't have the capacity to articulate the answers that you're asking for. So let's reframe the discussion with a set of questions. This is why G.K. Chesterton said that the riddles of God are far more satisfying than the solutions of man. The riddles of God far more satisfying than the solutions of man. God shows up, and the first thing that he does is he provides questions, not answers. But that serves a secondary purpose. As he provides questions and not answers, what he is doing is he's shifting perspective, not changing circumstances. When divine comfort shows up into the system, it is not for the purpose of rearranging all the circumstances to meet our very limited perspective as how we think things ought to be. He shows up and doesn't say, oh, this is your concern and you want pinpointed answers. Let me rearrange and establish it because you're the one who created the universe and holds it together by the power of your word. And so you know how things are going to operate best over the long run. In a sense, what he says is what we need is a shifting perspective, not changing circumstances. With a fresh perspective, we can navigate these really chaotic waters together. You see, he shifts perspective in a whole number of ways. You heard it there, and we can't go line by line, but it is interesting. There's some apologetic moments in this text that help us to realize, like, God himself really is speaking. Maybe you heard it in chapter 38, verse 12 and 13. He was saying that every morning the dawn defeats the darkness. Every morning. And he says it's a picture of the way that wickedness is going to be shaken out of the garment of the world. He said, daily I give you this glorious illustration that light is going to win. The dawn defeats the darkness. And then later in the chapter, he's just speaking in these grand terms, shifting the perspective, saying, look around, look at what I've written into the world. And then he says something. This is a really interesting one when you read the commentators on this, because there is a certain sense, especially progressive commentators that want to push back, saying this is merely human poetry. This is baffling. Because in chapter 38, verses 29 and 30, what it says is this, from whose womb did the ice burst forth? Who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. You hear what he's saying? As he's reframing his perspective, he's lifting his head. He's saying, consider the world. Every day the sun defeats the darkness. Consider the frozen oceans. There is no one in the ancient Near East at the time of the writing of this text that had any concept or category for a frozen ocean. They didn't know they existed. And God's saying, he's just like dropping these little breadcrumbs. This wouldn't even translate. This is one of those spots where their brain would be bursting. Like, what does he mean about the great deep, the ocean itself being frozen solid? Like, that's not possible. But God in this moment is revealing, he's changing and shifting perspective. He's saying, zoom out with me. My questions rather than my answers will provide a shift in perspective, not a change in circumstances. And I think that the truth is, one of the things that we have to wrestle with, one of the things I've had to wrestle with over the years, you've heard bits and pieces of my story. Everybody's got their own story of suffering, and mine is nothing compared to Job's. But when I think about preaching my brother's funeral, or my mentor dying in a freak bicycle accident, or some of the loss that Ashley and I have worked through over the years of our marriage, and I think about these moments that just feel so chaotic. One of the finest men I ever knew that did my pre-marriage counseling and gave me a vision for ministry, riding the bike around the block with his two sons and flips over the handlebars. On his birthday, the gift that he was receiving, had received this new bike. And it cost him his life. His kids watched him. Stuff like that where you're like, it doesn't make sense. And I want answers. And the truth is that I don't think I've got the categories to receive those answers. I want the circumstances to change. And what God shows up, I think real moments of suffering and grief and confusion, even on a day like Father's Day, where some of us are grieving the loss of a treasured father, or we're working through suffering with someone else. When we just confront the ugliness and the sadness of it all, sadness, loss, and disappointment has inherent in it a temptation to become a navel gazer. It's part of it. We feel it sucking us in. We feel like the darkness is so all-consuming that it's what we see, and we just feel like we carry it with us. We're trying to solve for it at all times. And God in his kindness shows up, and what he does is he just ever so gently reaches out and grabs us by the chin. He says, would you look up and look around for a minute? I think it's important for us to note, this is what God does. I think these words taken up on the lips of all these comforters that we've met over the last few weeks, I don't know how helpful it would have been. You follow? Like, this isn't now our game plan for providing divine comfort. It's, well, I'm going to show up and ask people some big questions and help them realize the world's a lot bigger than their suffering. This is how God... No. The point is this. God needs to show up and meet us in our pain. And if we're going to be the sorts of friends that create that capacity, what we need to do is lay down all of this miserable comfort that we've been seeing and love people and hold the space with them and enter their pain and wait, knowing that they need the presence and the word of God to tend to them. And when he does what he does uniquely, oftentimes it's in a moment of worship, or it's in a moment late night wrestling with a text, or it's in some unexpected moment where you're on a run and you see a beautiful flower, and it's like God just all of a sudden takes something so ordinary and lifts you up out of darkness. He's creative. He speaks in all different ways. But the truth is, those in the midst of suffering who are invited into their navel gazing need trusted friends to love them enough and to hold the space and to wait. Because what we need is God to show up with a new set of questions that begins to lift our head and provide a whole new set of perspective, a fresh perspective. None of the circumstances are changing, but the perspective is changing. And then in that context, here's what happens. Good questions, fresh perspective, leads to a revelation not of God's plan. Those who are trying to regain control, we want answers. We want our circumstances to change, and we want to understand God's plan. And he shows up, and rather than answers, he provides questions. Rather than changing our circumstances, he shifts our perspective. And rather than revealing his plan, he reveals himself. He says, look at me. The revelation is of God. Job, like all of us, wants to know the plan, and God shows up and says, look at me. Job is going, why this, God? Tell me why it all happened. And God shows up like P.T. Barnum in The Big Top. And he's just ushering past. He's like, consider lightning bolts and wild donkeys. Look at them. Have you considered the stars? How about hail? He's like, da, 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 da. Like he's just like parading them by. Look. He's like inviting him into the ultimate big top and going, look at what I've done. He's going, get a load of me. Have you ever seen anything like me? God is trying to lift his eyes, not just generally to try to make sense of the plan, but to finally see him in the midst of it all, going, is there anybody like me? And when we really see God calling the stars out, creating and sustaining the world, taking care of every wild beast. Do you love that in one breath he's saying, I provide the prey for the lion and I hear the baby ravens when they're hungry and calling out. You know who they're calling to? Me. I hear it. I see the wild donkey that no human being ever lays its eyes on. Those places in the desert where the rain falls and the grass sprouts and then it dies and no human being ever saw it. I created it. I saw it. It was all to my glory. In a sense, what he is saying is, look at me. I am doing so much that you have no idea of. Do you feel it? The revelation of God's presence is cementing this reality. Control was always a farce. You've never, for one moment, been in control of your life. Not for an instant. It's a lie. And in our chaos, the strain to regain this thing that we never had is a fool's errand. God, standing in the midst of it, is inviting us to recognize this is so not about you. It's so not about you. And once again, this is a word that the Father needs to deliver, that we need to hear him saying to us. It's not cruel. It's true. He's inviting us to this place, going, look at me. When you see me, you'll realize how much bigger this story is, how much bigger I am. And if you see me, you will realize that this desire to know the plan and have the answers and be in control is so foolish, far more foolish than the three-year-old that thinks it's going to be so fun to get the finger in the light socket. It's like, you don't know what you're asking for. You see, and this sort of comfort produces something in Job. Encountering God in all of his power, in all of his beauty, it produces something. You heard Melissa read it at the outset. Let's look at it again. Job 40, verses 3 through 5. Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. This is the posture of awe and humility. Have you ever been there? Like the edge of the Grand Canyon, the top of the mountains, the standing on the beach, watching the sun melt into the ocean. And there's just a sense of like, Job has been so hyper-focused on trying to solve for this very specific suffering. God comes and he asks questions and he broadens his perspective and then he says, look at me. And it's almost like for the first time, Job is catching his... there's just been too many words. All of my attempts at trying to maintain my control that produces this anxiety and this overwhelm. Like, it's not control that I need, it's worship. You see, if God explained himself all the way to the bottom so that we agreed with him, if he said, let me explain how it all fits together and everything that's going on, it's no longer faith and it's no longer worship. Now we're just agreeing with him. We're still in control. Like, oh, okay, that plan makes sense. I'm good with it. What he's saying is, no, I'm inviting you to look at me and trust me. And as soul-stirring and as beautiful as this moment of God's revelation is, it's just an appetizer. When he shows up in the whirlwind, it is God's presence on display going, look at me. But this is not the great revelation. This is not the great moment of his reveal. It's just a hint. just a whisper. As you and I both know, the full revelation of God's character in such a way that he could say, touch, feel, see all of me. It came in a little baby that didn't come in a whirlwind, but was silently laid in a manger, weak and needy. And as he grew, he walked through the world, Jesus of Nazareth, showing gentleness and kindness to those in suffering and pain, tending to them, seeing them, holding the space for them, loving and touching them in the midst of their weakness. And the response, the human response to innocence on display, to the divine presence showing what he is like, is that we raged against it. Humanity called for his blood and plugged their ears. They said, crucify him. And as Jesus was bleeding and dying on the cross, there's this moment. You know, we've been singing this song, Job's Lament. You know this song? It's written by a few folks in our community, Tim and Justin and Robin, a beautiful song. We're going to sing it in a few moments. And there's this interesting thing that in the song, it's capturing all that we've been studying, that Job is saying to God, where were you in my pain? And is this really the world that you made? Is this the world with this amount of suffering and this amount of sadness? Where were you in my pain? Is this the world you've made? And then when God answers in the song, the way that it's captured, it's so beautiful. He's saying, look, I made everything. I gave the gold it's worth. And then he says, and by the way, where were you when the nails were in my hands? Where were you in the pain? This is the world I made. And there's this interesting moment when we have to answer both of those questions. Why is there pain and suffering and death in the world? Because humanity, from the beginning to a person throughout all of history, has rebelled against the ways of God. We have introduced sin and the curses that come with it into the world. We broke God's good design. We're the cause. Yet we want to hurl the blame on him. Go, God, what have you done? And then interestingly, when he steps into the world and absorbs the pain fully, he says, put it on me. In this moment, when he asks the question back, we're the ones inflicting the pain. We're the ones that are saying, no, we reject you. We don't want you. We would rather be in control. We want to be God. And there, hanging and bleeding and dying, listen, the perfectly wise and sovereign God is saying, this is the world I made. The world that was going to end up with me on the tree. Do you feel it? What he's saying is, here is the answer to human suffering and pain. I've come for you and you're not alone. Humanity broke what I built, but I'm not hurling the blame at you like you do at me. I'm saying, put it on me. I will take it and I will make it right. And it's as we behold Jesus bleeding and dying on the cross, there's only one right response. This is the world you made. You're not cruel. You're not distant. You were willing to take the pain into your bones to show that you loved us and you're going to do something with it. Even though right now we can't make sense of it, we don't have the categories to understand how you can work in the chaos of all the brokenness. But I see you. And you're worthy of my trust. And so I will stand in silent awe and wait. Divine comfort. Ask questions that shifts our perspective, so that we can finally see God. And when we do, what it produces is not our control, but our silent awe. We say, holy, there's no one like you. Would you pray with me? Father, I see the faces of friends in the room who I know are suffering. And know that there's people in this room that have endured a great deal. I pray that you would be the one to lovingly embrace and speak to them, to remind them of what's true, to give them eyes to see by faith Jesus on the cross. Proving once and for all that you're not cruel and you're not distant to our pain, but you're with us in it. You're working in it. You're working victory and beauty and power and resurrection in it. Who is like you, oh God? Who holds the world together, who cares for every living creature, and who sees us and is working in miraculous and mysterious ways in the midst of our chaos. God, increase our faith. Give us eyes to see King Jesus. Help us to be the sorts of people in silent awe of who you are.